back on the record, continuing with the city.
Okay, the city would like to call Mark Mazzola.
Please state your name and spell your last name for the record.
Sure. Mark Mazzola, and my last name is spelled M-A-Z-Z-O-L-A.
And do you swear or affirm that the testimony you provide in today's hearing will be the truth?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mazzola. Could you please state your occupation?
Sure. I'm the environmental manager for the Seattle Department of Transportation.
Okay. And what are your primary responsibilities at the Department of Transportation?
So, broadly speaking, my responsibility as the environmental manager is to ensure that that we follow all the appropriate environmental reviews and regulations in construction and operating our transportation facilities. So that includes environmental reviews such as SEPA and NEPA reviews, obtaining permits, and then during construction, just ensuring that our construction projects comply with those permit conditions and any other applicable environmental regulations.
Do you have any specific training or education that's relevant to your ability to carry out those roles and responsibilities?
Yes, I've got an undergraduate degree in biology from the University of Notre Dame, excuse me, and a graduate degree in community and regional planning from the University of Texas. I've had prior to beginning work at the City of Seattle in 2007, I had a number of jobs at various levels of government and then even in the private sector as a consultant. In various areas of environmental regulation, policy making, and planning.
Okay.
If I may continue, just here since joining the city, I've been working as an environmental planner since I began, a senior environmental analyst when I was first hired before becoming the environmental manager in 2012. And then as part of the job, just took some training courses on the State Environmental Policy Act itself, as well as related trainings related to the National Environmental Policy Act and various environmental disciplines such as cultural resources or biological assessments.
Okay. So do you consider yourself familiar with the city and state CEPA regulations?
Yes, I do. And in fact, I was invited to participate on a rulemaking committee by the Department of Ecology to help revise some of the categorical exemptions related to transportation projects in the state CEPA code.
Okay. And more generally, do you rely and use those regulations as part of your regular job duties?
I do, if not daily, at least weekly.
So, to what degree do you deal with non-motorized transportation facilities in the course of your job?
As you may know, a fair number of our Seattle Department of Transportation projects either fully involve non-motorized transportation projects, such as sidewalk improvements or bike facility improvements, or a lot of times non-motorized projects are a component of larger roadway reconstruction projects. So, I haven't gone through the exercise of counting how many bike and ped projects I've worked on over the years, but it's quite a number that I've either evaluated under this state It's quite a number that I've either evaluated as part of environmental review process or team members, staff that I supervise, have evaluated as well.
Okay. I want to ask you to briefly describe your prior experiences working on environmental review for SDOT's projects more generally. So first, have you been involved in preparing EISs other than this one?
I have.
Okay. And can you tell us how many?
Two other EISs, one for the Elliott Bay Seawall project, and then another for the Alaskan Way Promenade and Overlook Walk project, which is commonly referred to as Waterfront Seattle. Both those projects also involved a supplemental review, a full supplemental EIS in the case of the seawall, where we did a supplemental draft and a supplemental final EIS, and then a supplemental draft EIS for the Waterfront Seattle project before publishing the final.
And in what capacity were you involved in those other EIS?
Very similar capacity that I am on the Brook-Gilman Trail Missing Link. I was the city's environmental lead for those projects.
Okay. And I asked you specifically about EISs. What about environmental review for projects that don't require an EIS?
So, yes, I've, over the past 10 years, probably evaluated, again, I didn't go through the exercise of trying to count, but I would say roughly 15 or so projects per capital projects per year over the last 10 years, and then even more so if you consider the number of projects that my staff reviews, and then I do kind of a quality control review of their work before it's published. And then we have a number of categorically exempt projects that get delivered by kind of in-house staff as well, or excuse me, in department crews that build those that we evaluate as well. So if I had to guess, it would be roughly 150 to 200 projects probably over the course of my career at SDOT.
Okay. Let me ask you briefly about your work with consultants on this specific project. There have been some questions raised about comments with the consultants you've hired. So first, how did you work with the consultant team that you hired to help prepare the CIS?
Sure. We worked very closely with the consultant team in terms of drafting the methodology for the various components of the EIS, looking at the discipline reports, and then the final documents, the EIS documents themselves, the draft EIS and final EIS. I relied on their expertise as they developed the documents. Then, my role was to ensure that their analysis were, clear, concise, and consistent in terms that it could be readily accessible to the general public and our decision makers.
And did you or others at the department typically review the consultant's work?
Yes, absolutely.
And did you offer comments or feedback?
I did.
Is that typical?
Yes, very typical. So while I'm not an expert in the various technical disciplines necessarily that they're developing, I am conversant in all those areas. And so my job is to make sure that their analysis makes sense in terms of not only is it logical and based on a sound methodology, but then making sure that it meets the requirements of SEPA and is consistent with how we've evaluated and disclosed impacts on other projects.
Okay, so did you, as the environmental lead for this project or any others on your team from the department, make consultants change their professional opinions?
No. Certainly not that I'm aware of.
And do you rely on the consultant's expertise?
I do. And, as I mentioned, they're the technical experts, and while I am conversant in those various areas of disciplines such as transportation and parking, vegetation and wildlife and cultural resources, I rely on their analysis. And then I look at it and then help translate that technical information and analysis into more of a plain language narrative so that, it's accessible to the general public and our decision makers.
Okay. I didn't have this at my fingertips when I was asking you about your qualifications, but I'd like to hand a copy of your resume.
It's been marked R35.
And is this an accurate characterization? You're right. Does this accurately represent your qualifications, your experiences, and your educational background?
Yes, it does.
I'd ask to have R35 admitted.
No objection.
R35 is admitted.
Okay, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about the project objective. So first, maybe just to start off with, could you please describe the project objective?
Sure. We state the project objective, I think, very clearly in the EIS, but to paraphrase, it's to complete the Burke-Gilman Trail with the multi-use facility that's appropriate for all ages and abilities for a variety of non-motorized transportation. We also include in the project objective the desire to connect the facility, the missing link, to the existing and planned non-motorized network within the neighborhood, and also to preserve truck and freight access to adjacent businesses.
And how did SDOT arrive at that objective?
So I think it goes back to the early 2000s when the city first started in earnest to complete the missing link of the Burke-Gilman Trail, which of course is a regional trail. This was the last gap in, the missing link through the Ballard neighborhood is the last gap in that trail. The desire then was to complete the missing link with the multi-use trail. And subsequently, that's been echoed in various plan and policy documents that the department has put out.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about a couple of those plans in just a second, but did the existing portions of the Burke-Gilman Trail inform SDOT's event?
Yes, it did, in the sense that we wanted to maintain the same look and feel as the rest of the Burke-Gilman Trail, which is a multi-use path, and so that's helped inform that piece of the objective, the multi-use path that's for all ages and abilities, okay, for a variety of non-transportation modes.
So I'm going to go back to the plans you had mentioned. I'm going to hand you a copy. These are not included in the binder, but they were listed. And I'm going to, at the outset, apologize. The staple is in the wrong corner, so it's stapled backwards. Sorry. And then we have the appendices, too.
Mark that as R36.
Okay.
Including the appendices.
These are the appendices. So, Mr. Mazzola, could you turn to page 56 of that plan? First of all, can you tell me, do you recognize that plan?
Yes. So the first document you handed me was the City of Seattle Pedestrian Master Plan.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to turn to page 56, please, again, and apologies for the backward statement. Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing now it's in black and white. So, unfortunately, this is black and white, so you might have to refer to your memory, and we can maybe replace these with color copies that are properly stapled. But for the time being, are you familiar enough to be able to, if you're not familiar enough to be able to answer these questions, you should just let me.
I'm familiar enough.
Okay, that's fine. Can you tell us, is any of the corridor on the preferred alternative identified on this map?
Yes, it is.
Tell me, what are we looking at with this map?
Sure. So what this is figure 4-2, Priority Investment Network, northwest sector of the city. So it looks like a map of priority areas for pedestrian travel within the northwest part of the city.
Okay. And so I asked you if the preferred alternative corridor is shown on this map. Can you tell us how it's shown?
Sure. So you can see in sort of dark and bold lines the alignment of actually our preferred alternative, starting where the Ballard Locks would be, going up to Northwest Market Street, then down Schulschel Avenue, and this is where it's a little harder to make out, but there's a thicker line along Northwest 45th Street in a slightly lighter shade of gray.
So, again, I'm going to rely on your memory of this. Can you tell me what the designation along Schulschel is in the corresponding E?
The designation along Schulschel with the corresponding key is arterial missing sidewalk.
Okay. And with unless there's an objection, I guess what I would propose that the city return on Tuesday with a color copy. This testimony speaks for the evidence we want. I just want to have a clear record if there's no objection.
No objection.
Okay.
I'd ask to have R36 admitted.
R36 is admitted. Thank you. I did hear you, Mr. Schneider. I was interested.
I'm going to ask you to also now look at the bike master plan, and I believe that's going to be in the binder to your right. And that is tab 7, and I believe it's R8.
An old
I'm sorry, tab 7?
Tab 7, which for the record is exhibit R8. Excuse me, tab 8.
Okay. Yeah, and so when I
opened those, let's pause to make sure we have a clear record. I believe tab 8 has been admitted
as R8.
As R8. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. Do you recognize this?
Yes, I do. It's Chapter 4 of the Bicycle Network from the Bike Master Plan.
And can you please turn to, there's a base stamp set of numbers, COS, and I'm asking you to look at 000105.
Okay.
I'd ask you to read, there's the first column, the sentence starting a small subset. Could you read that sentence and the ensuing sentence?
Sure. A small subset of the bicycle network are identified as catalyst projects. Catalyst projects are located at choke points in the network that pose significant challenges to implementation due to physical constraints. Catalyst projects like the Burke-Gilman Trail Missing Link also reduce critical barriers to bicycling by closing network gaps and increase safety by building all ages and abilities, friendly bicycle facilities to the maximum feasible extent.
So are these plans that we've just talked about, are these examples of the plans that you were just referring to?
These are examples of the plans I was referring to earlier, yes.
And do they reflect the importance of this project, the objective to the city?
They do. So as we saw in the pedestrian master plan, that the corridor we just described, which happens to coincide with the preferred alternative, was identified as a priority investment area for pedestrians. And in the Bicycle Master Plan, the Burke-Gilman Trail Missing Link is identified as a catalyst project because it is there's physical constraints in terms of the current users of the Burke-Gilman Trail through that area of Ballard, and the Missing Link would reduce those critical barriers to bicycling by closing the gap and increasing safety for all modes and all ages of non-motorized users, as it states here, and in the project objective.
I'm going to switch topics now and talk about the level of design of the project as it was reviewed in the EIS. Are you familiar with the design that was reviewed in the EIS?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so as the environmental lead for this project, do you believe that that project was sufficiently designed to identify and disclose the impacts?
I do.
Why?
It gave us the information that we needed in order to be able to identify and disclose the potential adverse impacts. So, for example, that would mean that we understood the project. Well, first of all, the nature of the project itself. That's kind of always a starting point. So what is the project going to do? In this case, it's a non-motorized multi-use trail facility. We understood where the proposed location of the trail would be, the footprint of the trail, if you will. We understood the areas that we've been discussing as conflict points, whether it's roadway intersections or driveways. We identified what sorts of intersection geometry changes might be needed, including any stop controls, such as new traffic signals, where they would go. Then lastly, we understood other elements of the environment that feed into our analysis, such as traffic volumes, parking counts, those types of things that really don't depend on the level of design to understand.
So you listed a lot of things, but I guess I have a more basic question for you. Does the amount of design that you need in your role as environmental lead vary depending on which element of the environment you're considering?
Yes, it does. So, for example, you could draw a line on a map with the endpoints and tell me, again, what the nature of the
project that we're going to build, and then I could begin to identify what the potential impacts to vegetation and wildlife would be. Just understanding what the nature of the project is, how it's constructed, and its location, even general location, is enough for some elements of the environment to be able to tell, be able to disclose what those potential impacts could be. Other elements, as I mentioned, like traffic and parking, rely on existing information that's out there today. So when we look at the existing conditions and then how we measure that difference of impact between if the project was there versus our kind of baseline no action condition. So things like parking counts today or traffic volumes, those are all, that's all information that doesn't depend on the level of design to understand.
And in your role as environmental lead, do you feel like the design was adequate to assess impacts in all of those various instances you just described?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And have you heard anything in the testimony from the last couple of days or in any of the coalition's reports that they've filed that changes your assessment of the that specific assessment?
No, I haven't heard anything over the course of this hearing that would change my assessment.
I'm going to switch topics again. There's been some testimony from various witnesses about SDOT's failure to reach out to property owners through the process of the development of the EIS. So did SDOT attempt to work with the coalition or members of the coalition during the design and EIS drafting process?
We did. So after the publication of the draft EIS and after the public comment period, we did reach out to members of the Ballard Business Associates, as they were referred to then, or Ballard Business Appellants, and engaged them in conversations as, along with other key stakeholders from the area about the preferred alternative. So we engaged them in discussions while we were narrowing down the various build alternatives to the preferred alternative.
Okay. And did you incorporate information you received into the process?
Yes, we did.
I'm going to ask you to focus on some very specific testimony from one of the witnesses about rail and rail operations.
Okay.
So were you here when Mr. Nerdrum testified?
I was.
Okay. And did you hear his testimony about the use of tracks by the railroad in the vicinity of San Jacinto?
Yeah, I did hear him mention that, but didn't quite catch or wasn't clear on what the impacts he was describing would be.
So can you describe your understanding of the location of existing tracks in the proximity of Salmon Bay Sand and Gravel?
Sure. So my understanding is that there's two rail lines that are immediately in front of Salmon Bay Sand and Gravel that would be actually be outside of the project footprint. But there may be other elements of segments of rail, further down the alignment.
Maybe to help with this, I'm going to ask you to look at tab 1 in your binder, which has been admitted as R10.
And this is the preferred alternative plan set.
Yeah, and I'll let everybody catch up. We'll be looking at bait stamp number COS 000005 and the following. So can you describe to us, you were describing two tracks and a third one. Can you tell us what, with reference to this graphic, what you were referring to?
Sure. So you'll see a top aerial view and then one on the bottom. So on the bottom aerial view, the plan set shows the trail, and then immediately below the trail are two rail lines. And this is
within the area of Salmon Bay sand and gravel. You can see on the far left-hand side of the diagram a short segment of track that doesn't appear to be connected to anything, and that's in within the trail footprint. And then to the south, you'll also see a third rail within the vicinity, within the trail footprint.
And does that continue on to the following page?
Yes, and then that continues on to the following page, which is the top aerial diagram there.
Okay, so what's your understanding of that third line, the one that you said is within the trail footprint?
So my understanding...
Let me start with what the understanding was when you were drafting the EIS.
That that section of rail would be able to be removed, that it was not necessary for business operation.
Todd, it's just to be clear, I think he said there was two. There's a little section on the western side, and then there's a third section on the eastern side. Which one are we talking about, the west or the east?
I was referring to the one to the right of the page.
To the east.
As we're looking at page 5.
But I will ask
you. Sure, I can clarify. You're right. It's to the right of the page or to the east or southeast near the Lock Spot Cafe. Excuse me, not. No, it is Lock Spot Cafe at 20th Avenue Northwest.
So.
Or is it the Salmon Bay? I'm sorry.
Voices in your head.
At any rate, yes, that's right. So, apologies if I misspoke. I don't. It's at the 20th Avenue Northwest intersection there.
Okay, thank you. So let's talk about both. You said that one to which Mr. Bauer was referring to the left side of the page. Mm-hmm. Is that connected to anything?
Not according to this plan. Design, no.
Okay. So let's focus on the one that's to the right of page 5 that continues on to page 6. Are you familiar with the current conditions in those vicinities?
Yes, I am.
And can you tell us what?
Sure. And so currently that it's not that third line, so that the topmost section of rail there is not contiguous as it's shown in this plan set, and in fact, most of it appears to be either removed or completely paved over, such that the rails are no longer visible. And there's a short segment that is still there, but appears to be partially, if not mostly, paved over as well. And that would be the southernmost segment of that rail line that's shown here.
And to be clear, the remaining two lines are outside the trail footprint?
That's correct.
Let's focus on what the EIS says about this. Could you, I think there's a copy, and here I'm referring to R1. I believe there should be a copy, right?
May I use this one?
That's the way it's copied.
Okay, great.
Can you turn to page 736? 7-36, sorry. Okay, do you see there's a section that says freight rail towards the bottom?
Yes, and this particular paragraph is under a larger discussion about the preferred alternative on page 7-36.
And so does this address removal of tracks?
It does.
Can you tell us what it says about that?
Sure. So if I may read the whole section under freight rail. So under the preferred alternative, the BTR tracks would be relocated between the Hatton Marine driveway, approximately 600 feet west of 17th Avenue Northwest and just east of the Ballard Bridge. This could include removing pieces of siding or passing rail line that allows trains to pass each other that are no longer used.
So stop there for a second.
Okay.
So was that your understanding of the track the track that would be removed was no longer used? You testified to that before. Does this capture your understanding?
So I think the first sentence there is specific to the rail that we're relocating, but then we do say that there we could remove other pieces of rail that are no longer used.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you can keep reading now.
Okay, this include removing pieces of siding or passing rail line that allows trains to pass each other that are no longer used, or relocating track to allow additional right-of-way space for the trail. All track relocation would be coordinated with BTR so that impacts on rail operations would be minimized, so that rail operations could continue before once construction is complete.
So if track that were, what does this say about track that is currently in use that would need to be relocated?
So that we would work with the BTR railroad to make sure any relocations or removal of tracks would be consistent with the needs of their business operation.
Okay. And if I understand, you testified that track wasn't needed or didn't look capable of being used. Mm-hmm. If it were, assuming that it could be, mm-hmm. Does this capture the city's intent?
Yes, it does. We're making a commitment to the railroad to work with them to ensure that their business operations can continue. And so if that means relocating other areas of track, then that's something we're committed to exploring.
So I asked you if you'd heard anything in the opponent's testimony that caused you to question your conclusions. I want to ask you, do you think that the EIS used reasonable and standard methods to assess and disclose impact?
I do.
And are they consistent with the methods that you've used in your other EIS experiences?
It is consistent with the methods I've used in my other EIS experiences, as well as conducting SEPA environmental reviews for all the other projects I've worked on.
Okay.
Mr. Schneider.
So, Mr. Mazzola, what permits, if any, does SNOT need in order to construct the preferred alternative?
So, right now...
Objection, Mr. Tanner. The permits that will be pursued and that are required for this are not related to the adequacy of the EIS.
The EIS lists the permits that are needed, and in addition, this is directly relevant to the conduct of the SEPA lead agency, which your pre-hearing brief says the hearing examiner is supposed to defer to. So I'm entitled to inquire into the lead agency's compliance with SEPA. And as I stated at the outset, the EIS lists the other permits that are needed, so I don't see how it's not relevant.
Well, in a similar manner that the, if I may respond.
Please.
The permitting that follows and any questions or challenges to whether a permit is required or isn't required or if it should be obtained or not is outside the scope of an EIS adequacy appeal. The fact that an EIS lists the potential approvals that are required afterwards is not relevant. It doesn't bring that into the scope of the relevance of the adequacy of the environmental review.
It doesn't automatically, and I agree. Can you expand on what you're trying to seek, Mr. Schneider?
This is the beginning of a whole line of questions, mm-hmm. and I am going to relate back to the requirements in SEPA for the lead agency to comply with. And I shouldn't have to set out the entire cross-examination approach in response to an objection about something that is specifically referred to in an environmental documented issue.
None of the issues raised in the appeal were whether they listed properly the permits that were necessary for the approval. There was a shoreline permit issue that was dismissed, but I'm not recalling anything that said this is inadequate because you didn't list every single permit that was required.
All right. For now, I'll overrule it. I'll allow the question, because the question is what permits are needed. That is identified in the EIS. So we can go to that page or however you want to explore that. But we don't want to continue down a path of cross-examination on compliance with those permits or criteria, et cetera. So
I guess I would ask that if you're testing him on the list of permits referenced as needed in the EIS, that you give him the site so that he can look at it as you ask him questions.
I'm going to leave that to Mr. Schneider's discretion on how he wants to handle that question. But
thank you. So, Mr. Mazzola, do you know what permits are needed, if any, for the project?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Could you tell us?
Yeah. So right now we so there's both kind of pre-project approvals that we need, if you allow me to use that term, in terms of the permit, and then there's construction-related permits that we'd be looking at as well. So the, in terms of the sort of pre-project ones, would be a review under the city's Shoreline Master Program. And then as far as construction ones, we are looking at an NPDES construction stormwater general permit that's required for any project that's disturbing an acre or more of ground. And then one thing where we're looking at right now is, as well, is a temporary, a King County temporary discharge permit for groundwater management.
Do you know whether you need any permits from the Surface Transportation Board to remove railroad track?
I do not know.
Did you make any inquiry to determine that?
I have not made any inquiry to determine that yet.
Did you distribute a copy of the EIS to the Surface Transportation Board or any other federal agency that deals with railroads?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Your formal training under SEPA comprises 2 one-day seminars? Is that correct?
I believe that's consistent with my testimony at our deposition. LSI's seminar, right, and then at least a one, I may have used the term as best I recall, at least a one-day seminar with the Department of Ecology.
Right. You attended one seminar put on by, was it Law Seminars International?
That's correct.
And one-day training by the Department of Ecology?
Right, as I could recall at the time, and that's still my recollection. There may have been another training in there.
Okay, and then you referred to two prior EISs, one for the seawall.
That's correct.
And the one for the promenade.
The full name is the Alaskan Way Promenade and Overlook Walk Project, which is a bit of a mouthful, so it's Waterfront Seattle.
Okay, and... So what is the promenade for those of us who don't regularly read?
Sure. So how much time do you have? The Alaskan Way Promenade and Overlook Walk Project is the city's plan to develop the waterfront after the Alaskan Way Viaduct is removed by the state of Washington.
Okay. And over what time frame were those two EISs prepared?
Between 2012 and between 2012 and I'd say last fall is when we published the final EIS. If my memory serves me right, it was Halloween 2016. I remember that date.
Okay. So you have been the person within SDOT responsible for compliance with SEPA for all of the prior appeals in this matter, correct?
I'm sorry, I lost your question. Could you please repeat that?
So you have been, your title may not have been the same, but you were the hands-on person responsible for the three prior DNSs as well as the EIS at issue here.
Okay, that's correct. I think my title threw me off. I've been the environmental lead, as you said, for the Burke-Gilman Trail Missing Link Project since 2007. That's right.
Okay. And so there were three DNSs, correct?
That's right.
And two of which Judge Rogers reversed, correct?
That's correct.
Right. And then the third one, Hearing Examiner Watt, did not be reversed?
That's correct. If the term reversed is the right term, but yes.
Okay. And were you present when Judge Rogers issued his second order of remand?
I was present for the hearing. I don't recall if I was present when he issued the order or if that's something we received in writing.
Okay. But you've read and are familiar with the second order of remand?
Yes, and that was the one that remanded the city to go back and provide more detail on the social segment, if I'm memory searching, right?
Yes. That's the one that said 10% level of design was not adequate and remanded it for a more detailed design.
Okay. That's the same remand I'm thinking of then.
Yeah. And when you sat down with your team to prepare for the EIS in this case, Judge Rogers' decision played no role in your determination about the level of design. Isn't that correct?
That's a fair statement, we felt we had enough level of design in order to identify and disclose the impacts. So Judge Rogers' decision did not play into our determination that we had enough information to do the job that we needed in this EIS.
And in fact, on the remand from Judge Rogers' decision, SDOT prepared plans for the Shilshol segment for environmental review that were at a 20% to 30% level of design, correct?
After Judge Rogers' remand, that's right.
Yes. And in fact, without waiting for the outcome of the appeal hearing in that BNS, SDOT went ahead and basically designed the Shilshol segment to a 90% level of design or higher?
I'm sorry, are you asking, did we design the Shilshol segment to a 90% level or higher, or the rest of the...
However you want to answer it. Missing link to a 90% or higher level of design.
Right. I think there's an important distinction there, because the original project going back to 2008 did not include the Shilshol segment at all, and that was the first remand that we received from King County. It was to add the Shilshol segment. So if I may, so we developed the rest of the trail to a further degree than we developed the Shilshol segment.
Okay, and was that to a 90% level of design?
The rest of the trail, if you're following my line of thought, to a 90% design, that's correct. Okay.
So, when the draft EIS at issue in this case was published, you were at a 10% level of design?
So, as you pointed to me in our comment response, we said that it was an approximately a 10% design, and that recognizes that there is no set definition of what 10% design means.
Well, you've heard Ms. Hershey's opinion that it was at a 5 to 10% level of design. Did you recall that?
I did hear her testimony to that effect.
And I don't recall any of the city witnesses saying anything different. Do you? Am I misremembering any testimony?
I'm sorry, I don't recall one way or the other.
Okay. And so when was the draft EIS published?
I want to say June, but it was summer of 2016, June or
not
July.
The draft. I'm sorry. I think you are right. What is your best guess again?
For the draft EIS, it was either June or July of 2016.
Okay. And then when was the final EIS published?
Then the final EIS was published in May of this year, okay. May 25th.
And when did SDOT make the decision to proceed with the final design of the preferred alternative?
So shortly after we identified what the preferred alternative was going to be, we started putting things in motion to continue developing that design.
Yes, and when did you determine what the preferred alternative would be?
That would have been late February, early March.
Okay. And is that when you engaged the Pertit firm to advance the design?
Objection, Mr. Examiner. We're now straying from the design that was at issue in the EIS and talking about the advancements in the design since the EIS.
I'm not sure I heard a full question yet, so I need to let him finish the question and then...
I apologize if I thought you had asked the question.
I still heard him talking when the objection came.
I apologize.
So it may have been almost over and you may have...
Well, I suspect when I finish the question, we'll get the same
answer. Okay.
I did not mean to interrupt you. I apologize.
So the objection is I...
If you could restate the question, so I'm sure I've got the whole question, so I could... Otherwise, I can't rule on it if I don't know what the question is.
Okay, well, I'm no longer sure what the question was, but I'll return. So, Mr. Mazzola, my question was, I think, so was it in the February, early March time frame when you engaged the Pertit firm to advance the design to the construction level?
And is... that the question you're objecting
it's
for.
Still the same objection. The timing is irrelevant to the fact that we're talking about advancing it beyond the design that was considered in the final EIS.
And it's directly relevant to the lead agency.